the Europeans themselves feel they owe the United States nothing as far as trade concessions and that sort of thing, because most of our investments in Europe have been selfish, whether economic or militarily. Do you share that view?
Well, I think both sides have benefited from this. I think Europe, we've rebuilt Europe through not only our own investments, but foreign aid to them. And I think, you know, what we're really getting now is a stab in the back from Europe.
Sure they owe us something. They owe us everything. Why should we have to go to war and beat somebody and make them richer than we are?
It's time for them to stop taking and start having consideration for the American people. I really think so. We've given to them and we end up just earning their contempt.
Well, I think it's about time that they did, because we've been giving a lot but not receiving.
Have we been giving a lot to Europe but not receiving? The Europeans don't share that view. In a moment, you're going to hear what Europeans say about the United States rebuilding Europe. Did the United States rebuild Europe, or did the Europeans do it themselves? The way the Europeans tell it is a completely different point of view from the way people on the street in this country of ours approach the situation between the United States of America and the growing economic and political power of the European Economic Community of Nations. They over there see it that we are the ones who have benefited all the way down the line. History will decide, perhaps, whether or not it was true that the United States, under the general blinding fear of communism, decided to rebuild European buffer states with Marshall Plan dollars and American foreign aid so as to absorb the impact of any first blow from the onslaught of the Soviet Union with its avowed aims and purposes of total world domination. The carving up of Europe, Yalta and Potsdam, as a part of the treaties made between the major powers even prior to the conclusion of World War II. The buffer states created after that time, voices of alarm lifted in the United States who told us plainly that once we told the German people and others there that we could not defend Europe without rearming Germany. The Germans from that time on said at least one very prominent person in the United States, Walter Lippmann, were in the driver's seat. No, the Europeans look at it completely differently from us. The people at Wolfsburg, where the Volkswagen plant, the main one, was located in the beginning of the post-war years, who broke up sticks and bits and pieces of their own furniture to fuel those blast furnaces to get a product started, not for themselves, but to build the German state. The people who sacrificed and went without in that horrible year of 46, all the way through 49 in the early 50s, to rebuild a gleaming, modern, new, a miracle of industrial resurgence and power to make West Germany one of the strongest economic countries and industrial countries on the face of the earth, they honestly just do not feel that the United States is the country that rebuilt Germany. They feel they are the ones who did it. And they feel, and they say so vocally, that the United States has had basically selfish aims in everything she has done toward Europe and toward West Germany in particular. But now, a dream appears to be shaping up to become reality in the form of a European Union, EU. In French, that's the European Union. You might as well say it, Union Europe or European Union. Whether it's going to be called a United States of Europe or not, I can't predict. I don't know. Whatever it is called is going to be a collection of states headed toward full political union, just as we have states and a United States of America in our country. It is a dream that the United States has favored and supported since the early 50s. Now, however, the United States may be having some second thoughts, because having begun as a partner and having begun as buffer states to absorb the first onslaught of an advancing Soviet Union, having begun as Atlantic partners in NATO, garrisoned by United States troops and dwelling securely under the American nuclear umbrella, but with their own multilateral defense force gradually being built up and the contributions, even though piecemeal and nowhere near so large as the United States might have liked, of troops and other materiel in NATO partnership. Now, Europe is becoming somewhat more than just a partner. but a very strong and powerful competitor. The Servan Schreiber book, Challenge from Abroad, pretty much underlined the challenge that Europeans feel from American industry, American ownership of industry within the common market. Sir Winston Churchill said it would be 50 years before Europe, principally Germany, could recover. Others said never. Last time I showed you the true proportions of the European Economic Community, just how big it really is in terms of percentage of world trade, and in terms of the powerful challenge that Europe now presents to the United States as a competitor. I had an interview with the press secretary to Chancellor Willy Brandt of West Germany, a nation that will soon become a full member of the United Nations. Herr von Weckmar is the official government spokesman, a man as close to Willy Brandt as, I guess you could say, Ron Siegler is to President Nixon. And I talked with him about what is happening right now between the United States of America and the climate inside Western Europe. He began to characterize the climate right now, politically, in the 70s.
Let me begin with an attempt to describe the scenery of the early 70s. We are witnessing now something that we have not experienced in the past, that our fathers and forefathers have not experienced, and that is we're entering the age and the era of multilateral organizations. The bilateral context, the bilateral cooperation is substituted by multilateral. Big organizations like the common market here, big organizations in defense like NATO, big conferences like the one in Helsinki on European security and cooperations, important conferences like the one in Vienna on mutual balanced force reductions, huge worldwide organizations, United Nations, GATT, the International Monetary Fund, etc., etc. So what used to be the old style diplomacy of one country talking to one other country has now been replaced by something entirely new. This creates much more of a sense, much more of a feeling of belonging together or belonging to such and such an organization. It creates also multilateral problems. We were dealing with bilateral questions in the past. Now we have a multitude of questions to answer, a multitude of problems to solve. The general atmosphere between this growing Europe and the United States is at the moment, I would say, hopefully only at the moment, overshadowed by the realization on the other side of the Atlantic in the United States that this Europe of the nine is not only growing, but is also a competitor in trade, a competitor in areas where both of us do export to in the third world, a competitor in Eastern Europe, among other things.
A competitor? Most Americans would probably respond that Europe is not able to compete with the United States, and little do they seem to realize that today it begins to appear more and more as if the United States is just not able to compete with Western Europe. I also interviewed Herr Franz Josef Strauss.
The Atlantic Alliance is one giant and a bunch of dwarfs. The Americans will no longer take it, as I know. They are suffering from overcommitment. They feel that is not a fair sharing of the burden. The new Nixon doctrine, the Kissinger speech, the so-called Atlantic Charter number 2 shows that the Americans want a new shaping of relations between America on one hand and Europe on the other hand.
What is your feeling about the Kissinger plan for Europe?
The Kissinger plan of Europe is a Nixon plan. It has the handwriting of Kissinger, but it is, now let me say, the adaptation of the Nixon doctrine to Europe. It emphasizes the American determination and preparedness to maintain the Atlantic Alliance, to maintain American-European cooperation, but they expect the Europeans to do their duty and to accept a change in the burden sharing.
We're living in a time of surprises, a time of unstable governments, a time of deep suspicion and divisiveness among American people between the people themselves and their leadership. You have to ask the question in this context, what about future relationships between the United States of America and our NATO partners? Is NATO going to last? And if it doesn't, what kind of a Europe will loom in the future?
A new economic power bloc with a population of 300 million people is rapidly shaping up in Europe. With treaties signed already, the European Economic Community has trade ties with 93 nations, with a corner on 43% of world export trade. Europe is fast becoming the supermarket of the free world. Future developments in Europe will cause us to forget Vietnam's agonizing curse on American society. How will they affect you, your family, job, and future? Stay informed and stay ahead of world developments through the pages of the Plain Truth magazine. Full color, 52 pages, with monthly articles on Europe and other issues vital to you. Be sure to request The Plain Truth, the world's unique human interest news magazine. Your free subscription will begin immediately if you write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, BC.
The United States government is no longer willing to make sacrifices, especially economic sacrifices, for the sake of European unity. In the light of our terrible imbalance, our balance of payments deficits, the imbalance between what we import from the European Economic Community and from Japan, and what we export to those same countries and to others, our economic house is in deep disorder, and we all know this and we all feel it. Instead, now the United States, because of our economic difficulties, wants more concessions from Europe. Now that they are more economically able, and just how able they are, you're going to see in just a few moments, in order to help correct the United States balance of payments deficit. Because the defense of Europe has cost the United States billions of dollars, Europe should at least be able to reciprocate, goes a favorite line. The Europeans just don't see it that way. The European point of view was expressed to me in Brussels, Belgium, by Mr. Etienne Davignon, who was head of the political committee of the European Economic Community.
The first comment I would like to make is that in terms of security, the security of the United States begins in Europe. It also helps the European security, but it is different than from what you were talking about before. The American security vis-a-vis in the Soviet Union, the whole organization of the American defense begins now in Europe, and as far as American security is concerned, has the same impact on American security as American soil.
Europeans have looked at it this way in all of the post-war years. They have known that we were creating a series of buffer states where United States troops and nuclear weapons, fully 50% of our nuclear capability at one time or another has been inside Europe, could absorb any first impact or onslaught from a Soviet Union bent upon pushing her aims along warfare lines, along either brushfire type wars, taking over one European state after another, whatever we suspected back in the dark days of the 50s and the time of the building of the wall. The lessening of tensions now seem to have changed a lot of people's minds. But don't for one minute think that the overall aims of communist leadership have really changed. Europe knows that they need America's nuclear umbrella. But European governments are not really willing at this present time to take up the immense share of defense spending it would require them to replace the billions of dollars America has poured into Europe in terms of troops, military hardware, and that nuclear umbrella. Upsetting the trade from Europe's view means job loss at home. It means that they upset their entire economic preferential series of guns versus butter decisions that are made continually, that they have to take away the good life from their people that they're beginning to experience, an improving standard of living inside European countries, and get into somewhat of the same difficulties the United States is experiencing with terrible commitments to defense spending. On the other hand, the United States is suffering from overcommitments. Commitments around the world, the Vietnam War that wounded and afflicted us so deeply we may never recover from it. A burden that has been placed upon the dollar as a result of this and many other factors that is causing terrible strain upon the dollar. And as a result, American leadership wants, even demands, concessions from Europe. Whether or not we shall receive those concessions is yet to be seen. But this brings us to an important question. At what point does the desirability for a favorable balance of trade and payments with Europe outweigh the desirability for the security of Europe and vice versa? I asked Herr Leber, who is West German defense minister. Will action by the United States result in a need for the creation of a common European defense force?
This is zunächst eine Vision, wenn Sie wollen.
Well, let me first of all say this is a vision, perhaps you might even call it an illusion. I am rather a realist myself, and I can only say we are part of this alliance, and we know that no country in the West today alone, without the support of its neighbors and of its friends and allies, can maintain its freedom and its security. So all this is part of a close and very good and productive cooperation which we must strive for. And we can only make our contribution, try to make our contribution as effective, as economical, as optimum as possible, as we see it. And this is also necessary in order to firmly anchor the U.S. forces in Europe, without which all this would be impossible, maintaining freedom and security in Europe, so on. All this is also required for this end. So this is all a cooperative effort, and where in future was changed premises and changed assumptions this might all lead to is impossible to say at the moment. I'm not a prophet, and I'm not trying to be one.
So the defense minister of West Germany admits that Germany, along with the rest of Europe, needs American troops and American defense forces inside the context of NATO to defend Europe at the present time, and doesn't want to speculate about the creation of a multilateral defense force to replace it. Yet Europe is still unwilling to make those trade concessions. Why? Here, in effect, is what America is saying to European leadership: that past U.S. economic sacrifices for the sake of European unity, and what the government feels is a disproportionate share of the burden for the defense of Europe, makes the United States feel justified in asking for some concessions from West Europe in order to improve our balance of payments deficit, which amounts to more, or did amount to more, than $9 billion in 1972. The president has said he would like an easing of the highest protectionist common agricultural policy that severely restricts the entry of American farm products into Europe. Many U.S. leaders are concerned about this situation because one-fifth of U.S. exports are agricultural in nature. The U.S. farm bloc has traditionally had a liberalizing effect on United States trade policy. Any alienation of U.S. farm bloc could result in decisive anti-European policies in trade. That's the building of barriers and tariffs, and maybe even eventually embargoes and complete cutting off of all trade. Also, the entry of Britain into the European Union has resulted in another lost market for United States agricultural exports. The president feels the United States should be compensated for this loss. And to top matters off, the EEC has signed preferential trade agreements with several countries in Europe, Africa, Latin and South America, the Near East, and so on. And this also hurts U.S. exports to these parts of the world.
The last Apollo flight lands on the moon while religious war rages in Northern Ireland. Politicians search for peace while pollution engulfs our planet. The gross national product of the United States exceeds $1 trillion, while some 15,000 starve to death worldwide every day. In this age of paradox unparalleled, where can you turn for understanding? There is a source that answers the frightening questions of the 20th century. It's called The Plain Truth. This magazine of understanding reveals the meaning behind today's world news and shows you the good news beyond. The Plain Truth is full color, 52 pages, totally free of charge in the public interest. Today, more than ever before, you need The Plain Truth. For a free subscription, write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, BC.
What is the European response to these American demands? Europe doesn't see it the same way we do. They see it from a completely different point of view. They see the United States as a spoiled giant who wants its cake and wants to eat it too. They see the United States as having done virtually nothing inside Europe that was not for United States purposes and goals. They do not see us as altruistic in our desires to give to Europeans. They do not see us as the man on the street may envision Europe as having been beaten to her knees, the United States then just giving Europe so much that it made Europe stronger than we are, that they are sitting over there atop billions and billions of American dollars which we just gave to them. They see themselves rather as enjoying the fruits of constructive effort, of nightmarish effort, of people going on 56-hour work weeks for very low wages and sometimes 6 and 7 days a week to achieve it. They see that they themselves have been the real catalyst in putting together a modern economic and technological miracle. Not surprisingly then to Europeans, the United States seeks concessions in trade because the United States has deep economic sicknesses it seems unwilling or unable to really repair at home. So instead of us repairing the damage here, we want Europe to do something about it. It's a question of U.S. guns for European butter, as this chart will show you. Some surprising statistics that you ought to bear well in mind are these. The portion of gross national products of these countries spent on military arms. Look at Japan, though a giant, super giant of industry, 0.9%, not even 1%. Italy, 2.6%. France, 3.1%. Germany, the same. And the United States, 6.8%. But what does Europe say to the United States? It says, take a look at yourself in the mirror. Take a real look at yourself, at your own economic problems, and don't blame Europe for your difficulties, and don't expect us to continue to pay for your weakened economic position. This chart will show you reserves in terms of gold and foreign currency held. And I believe it's shocking. It shows that the United States in 1960 possessed $19.4 billion. And in 1972, it went down to $13.2 billion. It shows that the European Economic Community, clear back in 1960, possessed $20.3 billion in gold and in currencies. And today, possesses, and this was 1972, the latest statistics we could find available, $57.3 billions to $13.2 billions for the United States. That is more than four times as much. It shows Japan having risen from 1960 to $1.9 billion to $16.5 billions in gold and foreign currencies held. So Europeans make the following points to Americans in the light of these shocking statistics. American troops in Europe are protecting American interests, they say, as much as they are protecting Europe's. Two, institute a stricter overseas investment policy, they say to America, which will slow down a large-scale flow of U.S. capital. Three, reduce your $4 billion trade deficit with Japan, which accounts for almost half of the balance of payments deficit. Four, mind your own financial house. Manage your own economy better. Lower wages in the United States. But how are we going to do that? Take a look at wages as they relate between France, Japan, West Germany, and the United States on the basis of present parity, I remind you, on the basis of revaluation of at least two of these currencies and devaluation of the American currency. Here is the way they stack up. The French worker makes $1.60 an hour to the American $3.80 on the average. Japan $1.90 and West Germany $2.55. That is the way it is. The Nixon administration has said, however, that it does not intend to agree to the European point of view. It intends hard, rather, to stick to its present policies and to try to get those concessions from Europeans. But what happens if the United States is just not able to get her economic house in order? Herr von Weckmar, the press secretary to Willy Brandt, had some commentary on this question, too.
I can't really see this for a number of reasons, and I'm surprised and astounded that we hear occasional critical comment from the United States or from U.S. sources, shall I put it mildly, Congress, newspapers, periodicals, and so on, about the community. Let me just mention three figures. U.S. agricultural exports to the common market have increased within 2 years, the years 1970 to 1972, 2.5 times. U.S. general exports to the common market area have increased from 1958, when the common market was established, until the year 1971, latest figures available, 3.5 times. American direct investments in the 9 member countries of the common market have increased from 1958 through 1972, latest figures available, 7.5 times. So the United States is not doing so badly in the common market. The overall development shows that trade balance between the United States and Japan, the United States and other countries, are much less balanced than they are with the common market countries of Europe. I do see a problem as far as imports from European countries into the United States is concerned. I do see a problem for agricultural products, and you mentioned one, that is the competition in other countries, in third countries, not only in Africa, certainly in South America in some areas, and definitely in Eastern Europe. However, if I recall correctly, it was primarily, if not alone, the United States and its major political forces that in the 50s were driving hard to get this Europe going, to make the community of Europeans a going concern. Now it is here, and the baby is growing. We're in our teens now, and we may be grown-ups pretty soon, and then the competition may even be stiffer than it is now.
I believe it won't just maybe be a little stiffer than it is now. I know it's going to be a great deal stiffer, because I have inside sources from unimagined places that tell me so. Not only is the competition going to be stiffer in trade, but eventually you're going to see the creation of a full political union with a full military power block emerging inside Central Europe to embody a tremendous slice of the entirety of mankind. It's going to shock its own builders. It is going to dominate a great deal of your news in the future. And while Americans sleep, or while they're entertained before this and other media, and while they play little games like, let's hide our eyes from reality and pretend, overseas in Europe, a powerful competitor is growing every single day, stronger and stronger, and is going to be the dominant force in this world in the months and years ahead. It's time you became attuned to what is really going on. Write for the Plain Truth magazine and keep listening to this series. I'll get along in this same subject next time. Until then, Garner Ted Armstrong. See you right here then.
You have seen Garner Ted Armstrong. Send your letters to Ambassador College, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Or Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, BC.